Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola, and today we'll be discussing the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which occurred in August of 1968. Okay, so today we'll be discussing the events that shaped the presidential election in 1968 more than any other, and these were the protests and police riots that characterized the Democratic National Convention, or the DNC. And let's not forget that the DNC is taking place in Chicago once again in 2024. And with me today are two experts to help us understand what happened in Chicago and the consequences of the DNC. And our two guests are Charlotte Lehrig and Gary Kissick. Welcome, Charlotte and Gary.
Thanks.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. Charlotte is assistant professor of North American cultural history at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, Germany. She has published a variety of papers about 19th and 20th century history. Her interests include the history of universities, the cultural Cold War, and Americans in Europe. She has also written a textbook about the American Revolution. Her current research focuses on visual knowledge and memory, as well as public history and media history in the 20th and 21st centuries. Gary Kissick is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Maryland. A poet and novelist, he has won the Pacific Poetry Prize, the Honolulu Poetry Prize, and a Penn Syndicated Fiction Award. Most importantly for our episode today, Gary was one of the anti-war protesters who experienced the brutality of the Chicago police during the 1968 convention. His article, My Riot, A Personal Account of the Chicago Police Riot of 1968, will soon appear on the website medium.com. All right, guys, let's jump into our time machine and transport ourselves back to the 1960s. Throughout the 60s, students, working people, women, and minorities were forming powerful and disruptive protest movements around the world, from France to West Germany to Czechoslovakia, and from Cuba to Vietnam. And the general atmosphere of counterculture rebellion was no different in the United States, where activists protested what they viewed to be unjust policies and structural inequalities both at home and abroad. America was involved in the Cold War against the Soviet Union and a hot war against the communists in Vietnam. Meanwhile, at home, Blacks and Latinos suffered from racism and segregation. Women were fighting against an oppressive patriarchy, and all of these groups were organized into protest movements. But four calamitous events in the months preceding the DNC in August of 1968 really set these various movements on fire. First, January 1968, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong launched the Tet Offensive, which flatly contradicted the claims of Lyndon B. Johnson and his generals that the U.S. was winning the Vietnam War. It was not. Tet really mobilized the anti-war movement. Second, in March 68, President Johnson shocked the nation by announcing that he would not run for president, opening up the Democratic primary to additional candidates. And remember these names because they'll come up again throughout this episode. So the four remaining candidates were Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, Robert F. Kennedy, the civil rights activist and brother of the assassinated president, John F. Kennedy. Then we have Eugene McCarthy. He's the anti-war candidate from Minnesota. And lastly, we have George Wallace, the Democratic governor of Alabama, who was also an avowed racist and segregationist. What a mix. Okay, the third major calamity occurred in April, when James Earl Ray assassinated Martin Luther King, the beloved leader of the civil rights movement. King's assassination led to 2 months of riots all over the United States, especially in Chicago, where the fearsome and powerful mayor, Richard J. Daley, known simply as the Boss, gave the police shoot-to-kill orders targeting black rioters, and 48 people were indeed shot by Chicago police. The fourth calamity was just two months after King's assassination in June, when Sirhan Sirhan assassinated the presidential hopeful Robert F. Kennedy. This event sent both the Democratic Party and the nation into shock once again. At the time of his death, Kennedy had amassed 30% of the popular vote in the Democratic primaries, and he had just won California outright. Could he have beaten Nixon and become the next president if he were not assassinated? Who knows? So throughout the year of 1968, tensions were high. Students were protesting the war. Young men were burning their draft cards as women were burning their bras. Black people and Latinos were asserting their full civil rights. And all of these groups around the country had for many months announced their plans to gather in Chicago to protest at the Democratic National Convention. Chicago, a city ruled with an iron fist by the most feared power broker in the Democratic Party, the Boss, Boss Daley, the man who also gave the shoot-to-kill orders during the Martin Luther King riots just months before. So here we are in Chicago of 1968. All hell is breaking loose once again, and the batons of the riot police are nearly falling on the head of our dear guest, Gary Kissick. So Gary, let's start with you. How did you find yourself at the protests in Chicago in 1968?
Well, I was a freshman at Miami University when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 63. And I had become radicalized at the University of Iowa as a graduate student. When I saw police attired like stormtroopers, discourteously dragging protesting students away from the steps of the ROTC building, that's the Reserve Officers Training Corps, I thought they were especially rude to the female students. And then I participated in some protest marches, including one that walked through the student library. Protesters shatter libraries calm is how that was reported by the local newspaper.
So in 63, you're at which university?
I started at Miami University in 1963, Oxford, Ohio. I wasn't protesting at all in 1963. I didn't become radicalized until going to graduate school at the University of Iowa. I started in 1967, so 1968 was right in the middle of my 2 years of graduate study in the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop.
So you've been using this word radicalized. You've used it several times now. What does that word mean to you when you say I was radicalized? What radicalized you?
It means educating oneself about the war and taking a strong stance against it and sometimes causing disruption. I joined several marches. I was actually born in Iowa City. I didn't grow up there. My mother and I returned to my mother's parents' home in Massachusetts when my father died while I was an infant. But my grandmother stayed in Iowa, and every time there was a protest march, the local newspaper would run a picture with me seemingly leading the march, which I wasn't doing at all. I was simply up in the front. But my grandmother saw the picture every time, and she didn't approve, especially of the march that shattered the library's calm, which even I found a bit silly. In a protest against Marine recruiters who were visiting the student union building, I had even managed somehow to single-handedly penetrate the police line. And I found myself wondering as I headed upstairs towards the recruiting office, what would I do when I got there? My father was a Marine. My stepfather was a Marine. Even my mother was a Marine. Fortunately, I was stopped by police on the second floor and they escorted me outside. But my wife, Rugby, and I hadn't come to Chicago to protest the war. I was not a member of SDS. In fact, SDS didn't officially send protesters to Chicago, though many went.
What was SDS again for our listeners?
Students for a Democratic Society.
And this was the anti-war movement umbrella.
Yes, Jerry Rubin and Rennie Davis, I believe, were part of that. But in 68, they were really working with the MOB, which was the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam. And that was David Dellinger. He was the director of that organization. But I wasn't a member of any of these groups. I had heard of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, but they hadn't really impressed me. I did attend an SDS meeting on campus, but that leader didn't impress me either. I knew next to nothing about their plans for Chicago. We had come to Chicago as guests of Mary Lou Plummer, and she was an older student at Wright State University whom we had met a few years earlier before moving on to the University of Iowa. She and we and her two children were on holiday together. We went to Michigan, and then we went to Chicago, and she wanted to show us the city that she loved. So we had visited the zoo and Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple and Picasso's 162-ton statue that looked like a winged baboon. And our only political act had been to greet anti-war candidate Eugene McCarthy upon his arrival at Midway Airport. And can I just say that Daley seemed to be tampering with McCarthy already at that point. A lane had been closed to the airport, which really slowed down traffic. And then when McCarthy came to speak at the airport, the mics didn't have any power, and it took a while to get that sorted out. But McCarthy was very good about it. But everywhere we drove, we saw signs of the coming confrontation. The peace symbol had been sprayed on walls. Anti-war slogans had sprouted like flowers. Bumper stickers proclaimed allegiance to Humphrey or McCarthy or even the late Robert F. Kennedy. The police were out on street corners taking claim to their city. The hippies and yippies filled the parks. Yippies were members of the newly minted Young International Party, politicized hippies, if you will, with a taste for theatrics and comedy. But the majority of the crowd thronging the city were those whose political views couldn't really be determined by their dress or their faces, people who wore no badges and gave nothing away. Many were the good people of Chicago, and others were drawn by the convention. Do you want me to go into more detail? That's how we got there.
That's how you got there. No, that's good. I mean, we'll get to the actual police riot in a bit, but you mentioned so many names there. We've got the Abbie Hoffmans, the most famous name, and stuff like that. Maybe I saw, Charlotte, you were making some notes there. Did you hear anything in Gary's recollections up until the time the rioting started that made you want to share something?
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear sort of a first person account of something that you've been you've been reading sort of scholarly works about for some time now. And what I find interesting is that the same names do come up, and also this perspective of saying that there were all these people who were not part of any group, who came just for whatever reason, maybe vaguely to protest, maybe for what was going on, maybe for the events. And I think that's something that is important to stress when we think of these events, that there were all these different motivations to be part of it. I mean, most people who participated in the protests would have been, they would have agreed on the anti-war point, but that was really that was the only thing they agreed upon. If we think of some of the major groups that already came up, MOB, SDS, the Yippies, they all had very different approaches to protesting the war. And I think Chicago makes this, the events in Chicago make this very clear, because you have, I mean, looking back, we often think it was like one big protest movement, but they were very different, even in the planning. I mean, you had the Yippies who were planning this sort of festival happening in the park, music, workshops, something like they had done similar events in New York, as we have heard, also a few months earlier in Washington, where they tried to levitate the Pentagon. So they were really into this sort of slightly crazy street protest, theater, performance protest kind of style. Whereas you had MOB, who were doing really straightforward protesting. They were planning an actual protest march. they also wanted to sleep in the park, but somewhere else in the park than the Yippie festival. So initially, they all came from different directions in a way, both ideologically maybe and also quite literally and physically in traveling there. But they did all meet there and they all faced similar challenges because none of them were able to get any permits because we already, you mentioned Daly a couple of times now. So he was basically sealing off his city. And I thought this was a nice touch in Gary, in your what you were telling us, that there were all these peace signs and slogans all over the city. Because usually when you read about also delegates coming into the city, what they remember is this sort of Daly presence with the posters everywhere saying Daly welcomes you to Chicago and all the sort of barbed wire and boarded up windows and so on. So I think this is a nice sort of other side of getting an idea of what it was like to come into Chicago in August 68. These people were coming to see what was going to happen. And I think none of them expected it to go quite that far. It's true that many, particularly the Yippies, calculated some kind of resistance, and they were kind of ready to face and taunt the authorities as part of their strategy. But I think none of them expected the kind of response that they got.
Can I just add to that? I think you made a very good point. It was not all young people at all. There were church organizations, and there were many older adults with conscientious objections to the war. David Ellinger obviously wasn't young. So it was people of all stripes. If you've seen the footage, you'll see that. The Yippies, I think, were more interested in theater. Like he said, they wanted to have this festival of life. And they were inspired by the Monterey Pop Festival, which had gathered 50 to 100,000 people for a few days of music. The Yippies wanted about 100,000. I think in total there were only about 10 to 15,000 protesters in the city. So it was actually a failure in terms of getting the large numbers. They had much larger numbers in New York and Washington, D.C. when Rennie Davis was organizing. But the Yippies definitely did not get any permits. And the only music they had was one band, the MC5. Have you ever heard the MC5?
I have.
You have, Andy. Yeah. They were quite a radical inflammatory band. MC stands for Motor City, and they had songs like Kick Out the Jams, Motherfucker, and Motor City's Burning, but the Black Panther snipers wouldn't let them put it out. They hadn't even released an album yet. Also, Andy, you mentioned four nominees, but McGovern was a nominee as well. Ribicoff nominated him, and that's when he made his statement that with George McGovern as president of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. Mayor Daley's microphone was turned off. But allegedly, Charlotte's nodding her head. She knows what all this is about. Allegedly, he said something quite rude and anti-Semitic in response.
I think we can quickly take this moment now to go inside the convention before we go out again, because we need to kind of dispense with the political outcome of the convention itself, which is almost less interesting than what happened outside. So after Johnson left the race, President Johnson, we were left with four factions, and maybe McGovern we could throw in there for five, but let's keep things simple. The major factions were the Mayor Daley faction, and Daley was such a powerful figure in the Democratic Party that he controlled all of the big city delegates throughout the country, not just in Chicago. So all of the big city party bosses, as well as the unions. So he was very much a union political boss. Then, of course, we have the McCarthy faction, which included the anti-war faction, as well as students and middle-class whites. Third, we have the Robert F. Kennedy faction. Of course, RFK has been assassinated. and he was polling a lot of the anti-war candidates, as well as lots of minorities. He was quite the advocate for civil rights. And then sort of the spoiler to all of this is George Wallace. And I think maybe our audience needs to remember that Southern Democrats, up until maybe this period in history, were always, Democrats were often in the South, and they were often segregationists and racists. And it was maybe this Democratic National Convention that led to the South being lost to the Democratic Party forever, because George Wallace considered himself a racist, a segregationist, and also the law and order candidate. And after the convention, because he did not win the nomination, he started a third party bid, and he actually won, I think, 5 states in the South and really hurt the Democrats' cause in the thing. But anyway, just very quickly, and I'm just going to go to the end and you can add whatever you want to. Anyway, Hubert Humphrey, who was basically Lyndon B. Johnson's pick, or got all of the delegates that would have gone to Lyndon B. Johnson, I guess we could call him the establishment candidate, won the presidential nomination on the first vote quite handily. So we talk about all of these other candidates, but at the end of the day, Humphrey won quite quickly. Did you want to add any color to the what was going on inside before we go back outside, Charlotte?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to think a little bit about the atmosphere inside the amphitheater, because particularly so much of the memory of that event is from the perspective of the protesters, and rightly so. But they, of course, have this idea. It's the Humphrey's going to be the candidate. That's one of the reasons why we protest. It's business as usual. And there's no way we can do business as usual in this current situation. But all of that sort of leaves out that there was actually quite a bit of discord in the party. And you mentioned the Southern Democrats, but there's also quite some discourse regarding civil rights and which position civil rights should have in the party plank. One thing that really keeps this convention busy is also a lot of challenges to certain delegations, particularly the Georgia delegation, because the official delegation is entirely white, and they come and have an alternative delegation. So a lot of the business in the convention is taken up by these kind of points of order, which are also part of the Democratic Party trying sort of to reinvent itself, or trying to grapple with this fact that they are, on the one hand, trying to position themselves as the Civil Rights Party, and on the other hand, still feel sort of tied to these Southern Democrats that have won them the White House a couple of times. And it's really a struggle on that issue as well. And because the protests are so dominant in the memory, we often think that it was only about the war. Also because McCarthy particularly ran as an anti-war candidate, but there were all these other issues that the party was grappling with, which further sort of contributed to this notion of chaos in the party, and of a party without an identity, and a party that can't get anything done. And I think that also sort of quite aside from the protests weakened the party as such. And I think the other thing you mentioned, Daley and his incredible power, and to really get an idea what the atmosphere was inside this amphitheater. I mean, obviously I wasn't there. I'm not someone who but from what I've read in terms of accounts is that this kind of Daley security also reached inside this amphitheater. You had basically patrols running. You had limited access for the press. You had very few possibilities to communicate because a lot of the telephones weren't working because there was also a strike going on. You had Daley security men stopping delegates when they try to get inside or just sort of nip out for some fresh air. So much so that someone like Walter Cronkite, who's really known for being almost sort of he's the journalist who's known for being almost impartial to a fault in his reporting, says, like, in one of his statements says this convention is starting in a police state. That's quite something to say for the opening of a democratic convention. And he wasn't referring to the city, he was referring to the convention center. So I think that's something to be aware of, that there was chaos inside and outside during those days.
Yep, I'll have to agree with you on that. None of us were there, but we could see it on the news at night as to what was going on in the amphitheater. Do you want to address the question of whether Kennedy might have won if he had not been assassinated, or should we leave that?
Well, let's leave that for now. Why don't you talk about what Charlotte just said, if you wanted to add any color to that?
Well, the way they resolved the Georgia question, Julian Bond was the one who was seeking representation. Julian Bond was a very intelligent leader of the black vote in Georgia, and they resolved that by dividing it 50-50 between Julian Bond's delegates and those led by Governor Lester Maddox. So it was a segregated delegation, so to speak. Walter Cronkite, his name is going to come up again for sure. Yeah, he did call it a police state. He said there's no other word for it. Daley was literally creating a border there where you had to get past his goons to get into the convention. And they were giving a lot of grief to McCarthy delegates. And at one point, someone was being removed. And Dan Rather, another leading American journalist, he went to interview that delegate and see what it was all about. And he got roughed up. He got physically manhandled. And that's when Walter Cronkite got very upset and said, I think we've got a bunch of thugs here, Dan. Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, certainly the most trusted journalist. He went to Vietnam, and early that year, early in 1968, he said that America wasn't going to win the war. It was probably going to end in a stalemate. And that's when Johnson said, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost America. I think the tide turned not after the Tet Offensive, but after Chicago. I had a very strong sense of that. But either way, it would have been a big result of Walter Cronkite's take on the convention. It was definitely significant when Cronkite said that he was happy to be getting out of Chicago.
So we were inside the convention, and let's now take a step outside the convention again. So Gary, you said you were really in Chicago as a tourist with your friends. But eventually you find yourself on Michigan Avenue or in Grant Park where these protests are happening. And let's just carry on your personal story now.
Okay. On the night of the 27th, we attended comedy at Second City, which is still in business in Chicago. It was highly political and entertaining, but not even Second City can tell me who we saw that night. Anyhow, after the show, we stepped outside and there had obviously been some kind of police protest or confrontation on the street right outside. There was hostility in the air. Police with billy clubs were everywhere. Young men stood in small clusters. Can I just say, a lot of people at that time were calling policemen pigs, and I thought that was very rude. But in Chicago, it seemed appropriate. Many of them had porcine faces and pot bellies that you couldn't believe. Anyhow, I stepped up to one of these gentlemen and I said, what happened here? And he said, hippies, yippies, whatever you want to call them, they tried to take over the streets. So I felt like a spy in enemy territory. Later that night, we were driving through Lincoln Park. Smoke and tear gas were drifting across the road and the walking wounded abounded. And Mary Lou drove slower than a funeral cortege. So once again, we had missed the main event, but the air was still electric. And I said, it looks like we just missed a battle. And she said, it's a giant graveyard. This is where they kept Confederate prisoners during the Civil War. And there are thousands of them buried here. And I said, how about Grant Park? Any buried there? And she said, not yet. And then I looked at my right and I said to them, look at this guy. It was a young protester wrapped in a blanket and wearing a blood-soaked bandana around his head. And we locked eyes, and he smiled at me, and he gave me the V sign. And I smiled at him, and I gave him the V sign right back, and that cemented it for me. So when we got back to the house we were staying at, the house of a friend of Mary Lou's, I said, I have to join them tomorrow. I remember watching Walter Cronkite complaining about the heavy-handedness of Daley in the International Amphitheater where the convention was held. Mary Lou had a 16-year-old daughter named Maria who wanted to join me the next day, and she wanted to bring her younger sister Adele as well. And I told Mary Lou I didn't think that was such a good idea. So the next day I found myself in Grant Park with both girls in my charge. And you know, if you look up what happened that day, a lot of sources just leave out Grant Park altogether, and they go straight to something like the protesters assembled on Michigan Avenue and joined with the Poor People's Mule Train. Yeah, really? It wasn't that, was it that easy? I'm sorry, it wasn't like that at all. We were assembling for a peaceful anti-war rally in Grant Park at the Bandshell. Now, Grant Park is between Lake Michigan, that'd be to the east, I guess, and this huge canyon of railroad tracks separating most of Grant Park from the city, from Michigan Avenue. So we were assembling for some speeches and music before our march. We were going to have a peaceful march, and I think Dave Dellinger was largely responsible for this. A permit had been granted for this the night before at the last minute. Now, memory's a funny thing. I don't remember all these big-name speakers. I remember Phil Oakes, who was a folk musician, who with Jerry Rubin had nominated Pigasus, a literal pig, for president a few days before. And I remember Norman Mailer. Mailer had the balls to tell us that he couldn't join us that day because he had an article to write for Esquire. Uh-huh. But he would later write Miami and the Siege of Chicago, which is a pretty good account of what happened. So apparently, and I only know this through research, Rennie Davis and Dave Dellinger, Tom Hayden of the SDS, and Bobby Seale of the Black Panthers all took their turn on stage. Abby Hoffman wasn't present, apparently, because he had been arrested that morning, they say, for writing the word fuck on his forehead. So he didn't participate in this march at all, despite the Alan Sorkin movie, The Trials of the Chicago Seven, in which Hoffman was one of the leaders of the march. So there was an event, something happened there, and that's that a young man started to lower the American flag off to my left. And from where I was looking, from where I was sitting with the two girls, it looked like he was actually trying to remove the flag. But he claimed in the trial of the Chicago Seven that he was lowering it to half-mast as a symbol of international distress. He was 17 years old. By the way, it was also announced that the Poor People's Mule Train would be accompanying us on Michigan Avenue, and that got a big cheer.
Just explain who the Poor People's Mule Train was, please.
Okay. The Poor People's Campaign started earlier that year in Marks, Mississippi. It was led by Ralph Abernathy, who was truly Martin Luther King's right-hand man. And Marks, Mississippi was chosen as a starting point because it was the poorest town in the poorest county in the poorest state. And the idea was that they were going to Washington to camp out at the Lincoln Memorial and to ask Congress to do something about poverty in the United States. They went by bus, but also by mule train. And the people on the mule train weren't always the same people. People would come and go. So a number of people ended up in Washington and stayed there for several weeks and never got what they asked for. But that mule train was going to be in Chicago that day, and it had a permit. So anyway, the police stopped that young man. I don't think he offered any resistance. But it's always been a big question of exactly what happened at that flagpole. I've read accounts that say that other protesters tried to raise a red shirt or a blood-soaked shirt on the flagpole, but I never saw anything like that. But I didn't see Rennie Davis being beaten by the police either, nor did I know who Rennie Davis was. My own feelings, by the way, were that this guy's an idiot. The last thing we need right now as protesters is to have images on the national news of a protester lowering the American flag or trying to tear down the American flag. They're already calling us anti-Americans. So I was happy to see the police take him away. I think it would have been a very bad image. But I did do some research this week to see what Rennie Davis actually said about what happened to him. And he says that at the very last minute, a judge named Lynch granted a permit for the rally in Grant Park. There were women there with baby carriages, families. Everyone felt this was going to be a safe venue until someone, this young man, tried to lower the flag. The police apparently went hysterical and grabbed him and pulled him out and arrested him. Rennie Davis says he didn't grab the young man and try to take him away from the police, as shown in the film by Sorkin. He said he threw a martial line around that part of the crowd and secured the perimeter. And it was very quick, and maybe the police didn't like it. And then he was standing there with a bullhorn addressing the police, just asking if they would pull back and withdraw so that they could continue with the rally. And instead, the commanding officer made the decision to attack. And Rennie Davis heard 40 to 50 people saying, "Kill Davis," with a much bigger crowd behind them. And the first hit was to the head and drove him to the ground. He was concussed. And then they beat him on the back over and over again. And he says he thought he might not make it out alive. He says, well, people managed to get him to the hospital. And he says at the county hospital, the police came to get him because they had attacked him, but they hadn't arrested him. They came to arrest him, and he says that the doctors and nurses put him on a gurney, covered him up, and took him from room to room. They basically protected him from the police. And the next day, he was back out there in front of the Hilton with a big bandage around his head. So that's who I'm going to believe, since he was the one who experienced the attack. So anyhow, this attack did not cause a riot right away. We went back to sitting, listening, waiting in front of the band shell. At one point, a photographer came up and asked if he could take my picture. I guess because I was so photogenic in my black turtleneck and black scarf. I don't know why I was wearing a turtleneck in August.
Hey, you are always getting photographed at these protests.
I know. I certainly did not take a black scarf on vacation. I think Mary Lou gave us all scarves, and this was to protect us from tear gas. You get them wet and you put them over your nose. I asked who the picture was for, and he said the Washington Post. And I thought it was just some little newspaper in Washington State. I knew nothing. I'm sure he got better pictures that day. So anyhow, after the speeches, it was time to assemble for the march. Now, supposedly, Tom Hayden was up there saying, "Let there be blood in the streets." I don't remember that at all. Hayden wanted people to go to the Loop, but Dellinger wanted people to march on Michigan Avenue as planned. So we assembled on a road next to the park, next to the bandshell, a straight road, 8 abreast, thousands of us. The girls and I were in maybe the 12th row. I looked behind, and the line just stretched out. I couldn't see the end of it. At some point, it was filtered back to us that the leaders had left to negotiate with city officials who'd arrived by car. Say what? Why would they do that? So we waited and waited a very long time. But they never returned. And I was aware that many marchers were drifting away, passing us on the left. So I turned around to see how many were left. And this was one of the most surreal moments in my life. I'd say there weren't more than 40 people still behind me. So we agreed it was time to go. And the three of us headed across the grass to the nearest bridge. It was now dusk. There were people scattered throughout the park. Most were moving toward the bridges. Even from a distance, we could see that the first bridge was blocked by the National Guard with rifles at the ready. Mayor Daley had brought in something like 6,000 National Guardsmen. A girl looking very distressed came running up saying, "They say to go to the next bridge." So we started going to the next bridge. We weren't quite running, but we weren't walking either. The next bridge was also blocked, but these guardsmen wore gas masks. And people were growing uneasy because we were trapped between this canyon of railroad tracks and Lake Michigan. And there were all kinds of rumors. These bridges were the only way back into the city, and we're starting to wonder, what do they have in mind for us if they're not going to let us back into the city? There were rumors that there were armored personnel carriers in Soldier Field. Thousands of combat troops were all locked and loaded. There were flamethrowers and bazookas. I don't know. And a mayor who told police to shoot to kill. You couldn't be too paranoid. So some protesters implored the guardsmen to let us pass. And that's when they tear gassed us. People ran, screaming in disbelief. Tear gas affects different people in different ways. We were okay just getting our scarves wet and covering our faces. But there were some people on the ground who were struggling to breathe, and they had to be helped. At the third bridge we encountered, I was never sure whether there were three bridges or four bridges, but I think it was at the third bridge that the bridge appeared to be open. The movement was clearly broken. There was no leadership in sight, no plan. But that bridge hadn't been sealed, so everyone went running to get back to Michigan Avenue. And the big miracle of the night was that as we got across that bridge, there was the poor people's mule train delayed by several hours. And it's just pure coincidence that we happened to be there at the same time at the foot of that bridge. And that raised people's spirits immeasurably. That's when we just spontaneously took over Michigan Avenue. And as far as I knew, there were no leaders there at all. Tom Hayden was supposedly there in disguise, and maybe Dellinger was there, I don't know. But it was just a spontaneous thing. We marched victoriously toward the amphitheater, which was at least 4 miles away. I saw Norman Mailer standing on the pavement watching us go by. I assume we chanted "No More War" or "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" I'm not sure. But I remember feeling subsumed by the historical moment, reveling in committing myself to a cause. And of course, this was too good to last. We came up against the police blocking our way. That was inevitable. The poor people's mule train was allowed to pass because it had a permit. I never saw them again. I shouted, "Don't worry, Mom, it's only America." And that got a big cheer. And that's the last happy moment I remember. Suddenly, the police surged forward. The next thing I knew, we were trapped between them and the base of the Hilton Hotel, though I was unaware of where I was at the time. And the Hilton Hotel was where candidates had their headquarters. They squeezed us closer and closer in a human vice. It was absolutely nothing we could do to escape. And I was worried about the girls. They were such skinny things. And it was awkward to hold hands because I was taller than they were. But we were holding hands not to lose each other until the pressure just got too intense and it seemed safer to not hold hands at all. We were wondering, do they really mean to crush us to death? When is this going to let up? Dell screamed and others screamed. Bones were about to be broken. They were pushing us off the street against the walls, but we could move no further. And still the pressure increased and clubs were flying, when suddenly the protesters in the back were pushed through a plate glass window. We didn't quite know what was happening, but that sudden release of pressure was a blessing to those of us not lying in shards of broken glass. And that's when all hell broke loose and we managed to flee down the street. And the police pursued with a vengeance. I remember three cops jumped a CBS reporter and started beating him. Confiscated his camera, I think. They just hated hippies and liberals and pampered college kids, and they were going to show us who was boss. And I'm quite sure that a lot of those beaten up were not protesters at all, but simply people on the street. I've read reports that we were tear gassed at the hotel. I don't remember the tear gas at all, but I have heard that Hubert Humphrey complained about the tear gas floating up to his headquarters. Anyhow, I lost the girls. I had lost them even while we were being crushed. Now we were being pursued. Some would go into the side streets like Jackson shouting slogans. I never saw anyone with a rock in their hands, certainly not a Molotov cocktail or any weapon whatsoever. We hadn't come prepared for violence. I slipped down to an underground parking lot where I found a phone booth, and I called Mary Lou and had to tell her that I really didn't know where the girls were, and I would try to keep her apprised throughout the night. At this point, I had no idea where they were. So I returned to the carnage and the chaos and the madness of the wrath of the raging cops. I remember joining some protesters in an assault on an abandoned police motorcycle, then being driven off by cursing cops. And for the most part, all we could do was try to keep away from swinging clubs and shout "the whole world's watching." And I felt powerless. I was powerless to find Maria and Adele, and my next report to Mary Lou wasn't any more cheering than the first. So I just continued to run, to dodge, and to search. Riots aren't noted for their safe harbors, but I did find one. I found a busy cafe, and I went into the cafe and had a cake and coffee as the police swept by with force. I thought this was a very good guerrilla tactic, that and disappearing into an empty parking lot. And this was also a good place to search for Maria and Adele in case I saw them running by, but of course I didn't see them. I just hoped that they had found some similar refuge somewhere. Then I rejoined the fray, and on my fourth call to Mary Lou, she said the girls were home safe. And she suggested a place where she could rescue me as well. I'll stop there.
Fantastic story. I love the imagery, Gary. Charlotte, I'm sure you have a lot to say.
Well, first of all, it's always impressive to hear sort of the inside story and not the stories that you have read. I mean, the Rennie Davis story, I've read a similar account, including the fact that they called that they are there to kill him. So I think that's one of the accounts that are best known. So in that context, it's really fascinating to hear another account and a personal account. And what I found particularly compelling was this feeling of powerlessness and confusion, which I think is often sort of sidelined when we hear about these protests, because everyone talks about how it escalates and how it's how the police are attacking, but the perspective of not knowing what's happening, which is a very real moment when you're in these mass events, this confusion and panic. And I think particularly the situation in the park, which, as you said, Gary, is often just glossed over in the accounts when they just start on Michigan Avenue. But I think the panic in the park is really what got people so worried as well, right? And it also highlights, I think, this moment of realization, like what you say, we didn't know what was going to happen, and all these rumors were flying around. This moment of realization that this could be really bad. This could go really sideways. And even though people were aware that there might be some violence, obviously, as you said, you'd said to your friend, maybe not take the girls, but you did take them in the end, which also sort of, again, shows us just how varied the protesters were, like people with children, people with of all ages. And I think this moment of realization is one that really symbolizes the moment when things turn, right? Because we can talk all about the preparations and how Daley ramped up the police and how the protesters particularly the hippies, put all these crazy ideas into the public sphere, saying they would spike the water supplies with LSD and things like that. Basically, also creating some kind of fear in the authorities, so to speak. But because of that, and then also because they had sort of anticipated so many more protesters to turn up, we end up with this face-off that is completely uneven. With we had some numbers earlier, just about sort of 10,000 demonstrators and about 23,000 police, including the National Guard. So that's a completely uneven, even without the sort of firepower, literally firepower on the side of the police, that already is an uneven situation.
And about 1,000 intelligence agents as well.
And that too. Yes. And that sort of added to it, both the Red Squad, so the secret police within the Chicago department, and also the FBI, which was sort of regulars, particularly when the Yippies and SDS was around. And also undercover police, some of which there is this debate among historians about how many undercover police. Some say there were as many as every fifth protester. I don't think it were quite as many.
Exactly.
But they certainly were there, and we even see that later on in the trial when two of them are being called to the witness stand. So, and they did have orders to provoke. So that also comes into the mix here. And then you have these everyday people just suddenly realizing that they are caught in something and can't get out because everywhere is blocked. First, all the bridges are blocked, and then the police lines literally press you to the hotel. So I think that really brings home this moment where the situation turns. You mentioned Norman Mailer a couple of times. There's this famous account or this famous quote. I can only rephrase it, where he looks down on the events from, I think, the third or fourth floor where his room was in the hotel. And he talks about a chainsaw eating into the crowd. So comparing the police with sort of a chainsaw waking his way into the crowd.
I'm not sure he was talking about that day, but he said, quote, "The police attacked like a chainsaw cutting into wood. The people saw the edge of their clubs. They attacked like a scythe through grass.
Yeah.
Lines of 20 and 30 policemen striking out in an arc, their clubs beating, demonstrators fleeing." Yeah.
There was another police attack the day after. They also attacked the McCarthy headquarters. So it's not entirely sure which one he refers to, but I think from your description, it might very well have been this one. This complete loss of leadership, if there ever was any, also kind of flies into the face of what later was the charge in the indictment, that there was conspiracy, right? It's not that there didn't go any planning into it, but by the time people arrived there, things took their own course.
That law about conspiracy, crossing a state line, conspiring to have a riot, that was part of the Civil Rights Act. And that was really put in there to counter black protests and riots, which abounded in 1967. Detroit was the biggest U.S. riot ever, I think, up to that point. It's a curious thing. And so that was basically a new law that year that they felt they could use against the organizers.
I just want to break in here now. We talked a lot about the lack of leadership in a number of respects, and I think it's important to remember that Eugene McCarthy, the presidential candidate, was in the Hilton after the hotel was apparently broken into and maybe some smoke bombs were thrown or not. But he realized as he was walking down the stairs, he was seeing lots of sort of normal looking people bloodied and bruised. And he finally gets to the lobby and he sees all these policemen there and then all of these young people handcuffed. And he goes up to a policeman and says, "Who's in charge here?" And all the police looked around like shrugging their shoulders. And that's when Eugene McCarthy said in an interview later, "I realized then that no one was in charge of the police." So I think that's an important point. But I do want to push back on several points that you've made here, or maybe just bring in some alternative perspectives. The protesters or demonstrators, let's call it, the counterculture won the narrative of this story. And when we look back now, everyone's saying how bad Daley was, how bad the police were, and the protesters were right about Vietnam and whatever. However, when you talk to Chicagoans, right, many Chicagoans were and still are quite supportive of Daley. These were outsiders coming in and vandalizing the city, and they were quite happy with this. And Black people, too. Black people were interviewed by Studs Terkel afterwards. One, famously a taxi driver in one of the Studs Terkel shows, said, if this were a protest led by Black people, they'd have been shot, not merely tear gassed and beaten. Charlotte, let's start with you. What do you think of those two points?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Maybe first the Chicagoans and the outside agitators. I mean, of course, that was also one of the narratives that was introduced. It was one of the first explanatory narratives introduced right after. Daley was the first who succeeded in releasing a report, which made exactly that point. So I think that's sort of establishing this narrative. It was also helped further by HUAC investigations claiming that there were communists involved and so on and so forth. But having said that, of course, we also, you mentioned in the beginning of the show, you talked about all the things that had happened that year. So Daley also had a good basis to tap into in terms of fears of assassinations, of riots, of brutality from protesters that he would invoke whenever necessary. So there was this fear of what's going to happen when all these people turn up here. And we have to remember that the protesters in particular talked about all these millions of people they were going to bring, that they were actually surprised themselves that only 10,000 turned up. So we may all laugh about this LSD episode, but it's just an example of how both sides were, of course, also sort of circulating stories in advance to generate some media attention. And I think in that context, it makes perfect sense that the Chicagoans were quite happy that law and order was somehow being preserved. And the other point about Black protesters and Black neighborhoods, I think that's a very important point. And I think we've heard in Gary, in your account, the way the Poor People's Campaign was really just a coincidence that they were there. And we also, if we think of the trial later on and the fact that they charged Bobby Seale was really more of a show moment than he had only spent like 45 minutes giving a speech, flying in and out. So the Black Panthers were absolutely not part of the organizers of these events. And
it was Eldridge Cleaver who was supposed to speak and he couldn't. So Bobby Seale stood in for him. He was only there for 24 hours at the most.
I would argue that the fact that it was a white protest is another reason why it's being remembered in that way, because we might have the same kind of debate about the Black protests and the riots after the death of Martin Luther King, but they are being discussed and debated and historiographically locationed in very different contexts. And I think that's an important thing to remember, both at the time. It's also one of the reasons why a lot of the protesters didn't expect such a violence, because they were white and middle class. Why would they be beaten? And you certainly have African American and Black protesters and in other contexts saying, well, what did they expect? And they should come to Alabama sometime. And I think that's something that also history has to account for, that this particular protest is so prominent because for the longest time it was the whiteness of the protest.
We all know about Kent State, but the first students to be killed as protesters were Black. It happened in February of that year in South Carolina and was called the Orangeburg Massacre. They had protested against segregation at a whites-only bowling alley.
Yeah, and any of the civil rights protests that turned violent in the years before and after, it was a very common occurrence. Also, in that brutality, like you said, the taxi driver who reacts in that way, and that would have been a very typical reaction, I assume.
And lots of the business people in Chicago who were looking forward to making a lot of money on all of the delegates coming in, this is a big deal. And suddenly their windows get broken, their businesses get spray painted, and all this disaster. The point is that Daley did not necessarily suffer. Maybe in history he suffered, but politically he didn't suffer with Chicagoans based on the police riot there. I think we need to start moving towards the end here. So I just wanted to quickly talk about the consequences politically of the DNC. Of course, Humphrey was the nominee, and then he lost to Nixon. George Wallace did not win the nominee, as I said, but he did form a separate party, which won a number of southern states that year. I think it's the last time that a third party in the U.S. has ever earned electoral votes in a U.S. election. But we can mark this as the end of the Democratic Party's presence as a dominant political force in the South. Of course, Gary, as you know, the Vietnam War protests continue. We have more and more student protests, and they culminate with the unfortunate massacre of college students at Kent State. So that's just a sketch of the political outcomes there. Why don't I just allow both of you to talk now, make some final points about what you think the DNC in 68 means for the political consequences, both then and then, how important you think the DNC is to remember today. Charlotte, let's start with you.
Sure. I think another political element that I would add to this is the gradual transformation of conventions as such, with the McGovern-Fraser Commission that sort of gets instated after the events, commissioned with finding new ways of representation, finding new ways of democratic with small d democratic participation in candidate nominations. Whether this has succeeded is probably a discussion for another episode, but at least there was this drive to change the system. You already mentioned sort of the end of the Democrats in the South. Possibly you could also argue it was the end of old style machine politics in terms of where Daley may have been one of the last representatives. I'm not saying that machine politics has completely disappeared, but in this sort of old school style. So in terms of political organization, I think this event did also have some ramifications, at least short term. Yeah, for the Democratic Party in their sort of struggle to find an identity, I guess. And I think another big point, and that's the point that a recent book has made, the Hendershot book, who talks about the news and the importance of the reporting and the question of how to report on politics and on events like this. On the one hand, and on the other hand, this narrative of the media is not telling us the whole truth, which you can observe in some of the reactions to the reports on the protests, and that's then later that narrative is taken up first by Nixon and then later even by Reagan. So I think that is an important dimension. In a way, Gary, you hinted to earlier when you mentioned this the change of heart that Cronkite had, but he's really this representative of old style TV reporting. And suddenly he's no longer trusted in the same ways. So in the Hendershot book, there's a number of letters quoted from viewers who say they've lost trust in the media and trust even in Cronkite. So I think that dimension and Daley really plays on that as well. He talks about the lying media and the way the media has not represented them correctly and has misrepresented the police. And so a lot of the rhetoric that we know today and that we've seen and that we continue to see sort of gets the first airing. I'm not saying it's the very first time ever, but it gets the first sort of major run through in the aftermath of the reports there. So I think that's another Leung Chongam effect that we could see from this.
I was just wondering, Charlotte, why did you say they lost trust in Cronkite? Who lost trust?
Well, there are a number of viewer letters and reports to say you never showed us the provocation of there must have been more provocation by the demonstrators. Why did you not show us them? This was a lopsided report. How can you be so biased? The media shouldn't be biased. And in this particular case, a lot of the reporters were attacked, and there are some memoirs from reporters who were in the fray, but a lot of the public didn't believe that in that way, and sort of assumed that they just got the half the story. And then with Daly releasing his report, arguing that the media had misrepresented him and his police, that kind of fed into that narrative.
I didn't actually realize that Cronkite had suffered any blowback. I know Hugh Downs said that being a reporter at the convention was like being a Jew in Germany. And I pretty much assumed that the whole nation saw Mayor Daly as a tyrant. But as Andy pointed out, he had many supporters who liked his tough guy approach.
Gary, final thoughts?
Well, I totally agree with everything Charlotte said, really. It was pretty much the end of machine politics in the party, and the Democrats lost the South, and that's had a major impact on our elections ever since. For those who weren't around in the 60s, there's a more honest film than the trial of the Chicago 7 called Conspiracy, the trial of the Chicago 8. It takes place entirely inside the courthouse, and it's free on YouTube. Also, there was something else relevant to the anti-war movement that happened in 1968. It's just that few of us knew about it until 1969. That was the My Lai Massacre. And that's when you got bumper stickers like My Country, Right or Wrong, a bumper sticker that could have served Nazi Germany. But what I'd like to close with is something personal that happened earlier that year that I've always found very strange. It was the night of Bobby Kennedy winning the California primary, and I watched it in our Quonset hut at the University of Iowa. My wife was asleep. It was about 2 a.m. Iowa time when Kennedy's victory in the primary was announced. I heard him say, "It's on to Chicago, and let's win there." And shortly after that, the TV went off the air. Kennedy had won every primary he'd entered. And I just had this feeling that it's not over, and I left the TV on. I don't know how long it was, maybe an hour. But then this blank TV came back on air, and it was reported that Bobby Kennedy had been shot 3 times at close range. How did I know it wasn't over? I think it's because of the violence in America. You know, President Kennedy was assassinated in 63. Medgar Evers had been assassinated earlier in that same year. Martin Luther King was assassinated in 68. If you had any liberal ideas in America and you were a leader, you were a target. And somehow I just knew there was going to be more that night.
Gary, thank you so much for sharing your personal memories, your vivid memories of those days. They really give us the color that we like in thinking about these historical events, and I'm happy I got you on tape. Charlotte, thank you so much for your expertise and your color commentary as well. That was fantastic. and everyone. The DNC in 2024 is in Chicago. We're recording this in May. Pay attention to this convention. It'll be fun to watch. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.